BCFM 93.2, the station you can count on.
The motion would allow a designated member, few of the Illuminati who are taking the powers to themselves. The Outlawries Bill has its first reading just before the start of the Queen's Speech debate. To interrupt the Queen's speech to debate a backbench bill such as the one proposed in this motion would be unprecedented.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. The poor Rohingyas, why do the Muslims always get it in the neck, just like the Jews in the 1930s maybe? Funny that, we look at who's been selling arms to the Aung San Suu Kyi's brutal Burmese government. But more to the point, who's been bearing gifts of arms and encouraged the Rohingyas to think that they could successfully rise up in the first place? And the attempt to assassinate Soviet leader Stalin. What does it tell us about who was really in charge at that point in Nazi Germany? And hint, hint, Martin Bormann in England, filling the gap between his being rescued from Berlin in the book Op JB to popping up in Paraguay and Argentina in Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile in 1956. Where was he in between? In Surrey? Well, listeners have said they want to hear more about Bormann. You certainly will tonight. And what happens if you're ordered to carry out an assassination and paid very nicely for it? There's always the possibility that you might be killed yourself. We hear from one man who survived at least two attempts on his life after he assassinated a former US politician. Our sister show Dialects here on BCFM, Tuesday at noon this week. Anglo-Saxon Democracy is the title of a book by Bristol Green Party's former mayor candidate Tony Dyer. He takes a good look at what used to be called the Dark Ages and how our ancestors made their way from the Roman occupation to the Norman invasion, with the interruption of a few Vikings along the way. Also, Charles Shi joins us once more. He's a whistleblower from the Chinese aviation industry, warning of fake parts being fitted to Boeing airliners. But Boeing don't want to know. Neither does the regulator, the FAA. He tells us how his home was broken into just after the second of the two 737 MAX 8 crashes earlier this year. You can listen here at BCFM 93.2 at noon next Tuesday, or download it right now, Dialect that is, from bcfmradio.com/dialect. Or even dialectradio.co.uk. Start this week, Martin, with the sacking of Mike Pompeo. Is this good? Is
not Trump Mike doing Pompeo. The
Sorry. of John only. Bolton. Well, who would you have preferred to have been sacked?
Well, apparently they didn't get on, and that's one of the reasons why Bolton's got the
But they do seem to be on the same page when it comes to Iran, don't they?
Yeah, they did, but I think Trump has basically stared into the abyss and realised that he can't really go along with Bolton's strategy of attacking, gratuitously attacking Iran, because the consequences would be absolutely horrendous, as anybody with any sense would recognise.
So, I mean, this. Do you think Trump is... I mean, it was one of those press conferences he held. He said something like, well, Bolton was a bit too hawkish for me. I'm more dove-like. And is Trump really... I mean, is that any...
Well, I think the problem with Trump... The problem with Trump is if you're opposed to him, he's a very, very mercurial character. He spins on a sixpence. And if you're kind of support him, he's a very mercurial character and he spins on a sixpence. So he sends contradictory messages out. You know, he threatens to nuke Afghanistan, and then he talks to the Taliban, and then he decides he's not talking to the Taliban.
Okay, so
you never know where you are.
The National Security Advisor sits around what, some sort of cabinet table, or what is it?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't...
National Security
yeah,
Council.
Yeah, I mean, basically, that's a very powerful role.
Yeah.
Because they, you know, you're basically coordinating.
You're not actually
US
making decisions,
strategy,
though, are you? You've got the ear of the president, but you're not making decisions.
Well, to be honest with you, the president's largely a figurehead. The people who make the decisions are people like Bolton and people further down the line whose names we don't know.
Well, people further down the line, maybe his deputy who's now taking over from him, a former member of the Reagan administration who held executive positions with Boeing and Lockheed Martin, was named to be acting national security advisor following the departure of John Bolton. Chance Kupperman is 68 and he joined the Trump administration as deputy national security advisor in January. White House spokesman Hogan Gidley said Kupperman would serve as acting national security advisor until President Trump names a permanent replacement.
Well, I mean, I've never heard of this guy before.
I can tell you a little bit about him. I've done. Lockheed Martin and Boeing.
Yeah, but you can pretty much guarantee that this isn't going to be somebody who is, you know, the way these decisions are made in the US, it's the military-industrial complex and the banks pretty much get what they want, whoever the president is.
Well, the Fox News has done a little bit of research into this chap. It opposed Kupperman's appointment, apparently, by the Council on American Islamic Relations, a leading Muslim civil rights group, immediately called for his resignation, saying his nearly decade-long tenure with the Center for Security Policy, which CARE regards as an anti-Muslim hate group. Kupperman was a member of CSP's board from 2001 to 2011. The group was founded by Frank Gaffney Jr., another former member of the Reagan administration.
I've heard of him.
Critics have charged that CSP has promoted conspiracy theories, including that Muslim Brotherhood has infiltrated the US government and that creeping Sharia law is a threat to US democracy. And what narratives are these? We've heard these before, haven't we?
Yeah, we have. And what's fascinating is that in the world at large, the support for the Muslim Brotherhood in the Middle East is that the US, aligned with Turkey, aligned with the terrorists in Syria, are aligned with the Muslim Brotherhood to some extent. So the idea that the Muslim Brotherhood has taken over the US is rather fanciful. In actual fact, the US has taken over the Muslim Brotherhood is the way to think about it.
Also this week, Israel is accused of planting mysterious spying devices near the White House. These likely Israeli spy efforts were uncovered during the Trump presidency, several former top US officials said. The US government concluded within the past 2 years Israel was behind the placement of cell phone surveillance devices that were found near the White House and other sensitive locations around Washington, according to three former US officials with knowledge of the matter. But unlike most other occasions when flagrant incidents of foreign spying have been discovered on American soil, the Trump administration did not rebuke the Israeli government. There were no consequences.
Well, I mean, the Israelis are very determined to control US policy and British policy, and their spies, including electronic spies, are very active. Because it's very important to them to control those things.
The miniature surveillance devices, colloquially known as stingrays, mimic regular cell towers to fool cell phones into giving them their locations and identity, formerly called International Mobile Subscriber Identity Catchers. They also capture the contents of calls and the data use. So yeah, that may be passwords, that sort of thing, the president for senior people. Were the Israelis allowed to do this kind of thing wherever they want?
Well, it looks like it. They've been caught red-handed and they haven't even been told off. So I think it says yes that they are allowed to do this stuff, doesn't it, Tony?
Well,
could you imagine if the Russians had been found planting these bugs? We'd have certainly heard about it on front for days on the news, wouldn't we?
Well, maybe the Russians have planted them and made them look like Israeli ones.
Well, that's we're moving into if the Americans have said they are Israeli ones, I think you can pretty much guarantee that they are, because if they could have blamed the Russians for it, then probably would if they could have got away with it.
Trump is reputed to be lax in observing White House security protocols, so is that partly his fault, do you think, then?
Well, they've withdrawn this spy from Putin's inner circle because they said that they thought Trump might grass this guy up to Putin. I think this is a Democrat stuff in the US where they're going on about how Trump's not to be trusted to run the military-industrial complex because he's too dovish, which is absurd, but there you are.
Well, what do you make of this complete breakdown in the peace process in Afghanistan with the Americans now saying, okay, well, we're not going to be pulling out now, we're staying, huh?
Well, I'm afraid that it was always going to be a long shot that was going to work. because the demands of the Taliban and the demands of the Americans are completely diametrically opposed to something. The Americans basically want to keep bases in Afghanistan to threaten the Chinese and the Russians, and they don't want to leave. And the Taliban are saying, we're not going to talk to anybody. You've got to take all your troops away before we'll, you know, we're not talking to the Afghan government until you've gone. And, of course, they are in quite a strong position, as all these insurgencies are, because it's their country. And at the end of the day, the other side's going to get bored first, you know, because they, you know, they're eventually going to give up.
Okay, back to John Bolton. And Trump said that Bolton was holding him back on Venezuela and Cuba, that he wanted to do more to intervene there. And Bolton said no.
Well, that is a turn up for the books, because, of course, as far as I can see, Bolton was definitely pushing for more extreme. But you can see
how... I mean, this is actually partly Trump here saying, well, actually, Bolton is not tougher than me, the president says.
Yes, so, it's all about perception. In actual fact, what's very interesting is that Bolton says he's resigned and Trump says he's sacked. So there's two accounts of what happened there. The ego has landed. Can you imagine the two egos clashing like that? I certainly can. I'm not a pretty sight, I would have thought.
Okay, so the foreign policy in the United States, do you think it's going to change now Bolton's gone? Is it going to get better, worse?
Right across the spectrum, there's a pretty stupid gung-ho attitude in US politics to the outside world. So you can't really expect much to change. But at least, as I was reading quite an interesting piece on The Saker this week, was saying, well, one positive thing is whoever's appointed couldn't be worse than Bolton. Yeah? Bolton's pretty bad, and they could probably appoint somebody just as bad.
I mean,
couldn't be worse.
Potentially appoint somebody directly from the arms companies that want a war?
Well, I mean, that's almost certain to happen. I mean, there's no doubt that that's what will happen. There's nobody that's going to be appointed to this role in the Trump administration who's going to be anything less than a warmonger. That's the job description.
Okay, well, let's go now to listen to a clip from the BBC World Service this week, and what I thought was an excellent report by Jonathan Head over in Bangladesh and in Burma, or Myanmar as it's now called, looking at the return of the Rohingyas. That's not happened. 200,000 of them had to leave Burma. And Martin and I afterwards will discuss who exactly it was that was fueling this conflict and how they got it going in the first place. And now we've got nearly 250,000 people caught up in it.
2 years after 100,000 Muslim Rohingyas fled from a savage military operation, the great majority remained stuck in overcrowded camps in Bangladesh. A second attempt to start repatriating the refugees failed last month when none of the 3,500 selected would agree to go. They cited fears for their safety and uncertainty over a future where they would still be denied citizenship. The government of Myanmar says it's committed to bringing them back and recently brought a group of journalists to Northern Rakhine State, which is usually off limits, to see their preparations. However, our correspondent Jonathan Head was able to find evidence that far from welcoming the Rohingyas back, the authorities in Rakhine State have been erasing all trace of their villages.
Inside a prefabricated hut, not far from the border with Bangladesh, Burmese immigration officials demonstrate all the preparations they've made to process returning Rohingya refugees. There are fingerprint kits, a photo booth, clothing packages for men and women, and of course, reams of forms to fill in. They've been showing this to journalists for more than a year now, but so far, only a handful of Rohingyas have dared to make the crossing back to Myanmar.
Well, we've been allowed to walk right up to the border post. It's a rusting gate through which they say they were expecting possibly thousands of Rohingyas to come back. And you can see probably about 200 metres in the distance is the Bangladeshi side of the border. This gate has been closed, we understand, for months. A visible symbol of the failed repatriation efforts. If significant numbers of Rohingya refugees do decide to come back, this is where they're likely to spend at least their first 2 months. It's a transit camp. It's pretty basic. It's also fenced in with watchtowers and armed police. It's unlikely they'll be free to come and go. But a much bigger question hangs over what they do after that. Of course, they'd like to go back to their villages, but hundreds of them have been damaged or destroyed, not just by the violence of 2 years ago, but they've continued to be demolished even since then. In fact, this very camp is built on the site of what was an intact Rohingya village that was then bulldozed.
The camp administrator, So Shwe Ong, appeared unaware of the Rohingya village, which had been flattened right under where he was standing.
Can I ask, why did you destroy the village, the Muslim village that was here, to build this camp?
There were no villages here, he told me.
But I've seen the satellite pictures. There was very clearly a village here, right in the place that this camp is.
But when I mentioned satellite images showing more or less intact villages in late 2017, which are then seen being cleared and built on through the following year, he said he'd only taken the job recently and could not give me an answer.
Well, they've taken us now to what they call a relocation camp, dozens of brand new, rather basic houses, where they expect most Rohingyas, if they come back, to live. Now, this is certainly a great deal better than where those refugees are living right now in Bangladesh. There's lots of space, it's clean, there are decent facilities, but it's also next to some very heavy security. It's unlikely they'd have freedom of movement. Rohingyas don't have that, nor that they would get citizenship. And you have to remember that, like so much other new construction that we've seen in Rakhine State, this camp too was built only after demolishing existing Rohingya villages. In fact, it's clear the government has no intention of allowing most of the Rohingyas to go back to their old lives.
Since Myanmar got independence, we have been persecuted till now.
For the whole of our tour of northern Rakhine State, we were never allowed to speak to ordinary people without being monitored constantly by police special branch. But I was able to speak briefly to a young Rohingya man who's been stuck in an IDP camp for 7 years after an earlier outbreak of communal violence. It's illegal for foreigners to meet Rohingyas without permission, so we can't use his name.
You know, we cannot go anywhere. So as long as we cannot have freedom of movement, we cannot have our identity. The people who are in Bangladesh, they say like that. We don't want to go back without protection, without identity and freedom of movement.
Well, this is perhaps the strangest part of this highly organized government tour. They brought us to a village called Indin, which is notorious for a massacre of Rohingya men 2 years ago, and for which two Reuters journalists went to prison for investigating. Now, it seems the government wants us to understand how safe and peaceful this community is now, at least its non-Muslim Rakhine Buddhist part. But you've only got to walk a few hundred metres over to a high barbed wire fence. That was where the Rohingyas used to live. Their community has been obliterated, replaced with, well, it looks like there's quite a lot of construction going on now. There are a lot of new buildings, some kind of barracks. It's clear from looking at that, that the Muslims are never coming back here, even if they want to.
That's Jonathan Head reporting from Rakhine State.
Well, you know, I listened with interest to that. It's obviously an ongoing conflict. The main point I'd make about this is that the Chinese are planning to build a state-of-the-art railway structure all the way through Burma to the sea.
Part of the Belt and Road.
Yeah, this is part of the Belt and Road initiative. And of course, this where the Rohingyas live in Burma is exactly where they want to this railroad to debouch into the Indian Ocean. And so this conflict actually messes that up. And you mentioned earlier obviously it's difficult to see from the outside, but we know that the Saudis, for example, were encouraging. This whole process began with attacks on police stations by Rohingya militants. Armed militants attacked police stations, and then Of course, the military was just pretty tough in Burma because they've got lots of separatists, the Karen army and others that they're fighting, you know. There's lots of separatist groups inside Burma. They came in heavy-handed, and of course the ordinary people who are neither terrorists or anything else, they're the ones who bear the brunt of it. But of course, from the purpose of all of this is to mess. You know, this is the same thing's going on in Baluchistan in Pakistan. Is basically to make it difficult for the Chinese to do what they want to do.
Is it just coincidence that the Muslims have got it in the neck again?
Well, no. I mean, the point is that the these kind of conflicts between different groups are grist to the mill of those.
I mean, it's happening in Palestine, isn't it? It's happening in Kashmir.
It's happening all over the place.
It's happening in many parts.
Yeah, but
in
other parts,
in Afghanistan.
In other parts of the world, you know, you've got Muslim dictatorships who are leaning on people that they don't like. Yazidis, for example, in Iraq, who are not Muslim, are persecuted by ISIS.
The Saudis say they're Muslim. It's a Muslim monarchy.
Well, the Muslim monarchy, but the Shia are constantly abused and attacked in Saudi Arabia.
And some of the Sunni too. Anyway, looking at the funding for... where do the guns come from to start this conflict?
Well, I think what's happened is the Saudis have worked, because they were possibly behind the bombings in Sri Lanka, if you remember, of the Christian community, by Muslim extremists. You've got to recognise that underlying all of this is
certainly evidence for
geopolitical
that.
Manipulations. Yeah, the
BBC,
conflicts can be used to.
Can we just focus on this particular one?
Yeah, let's focus on this.
Myanmar. There's a great article the BBC have done. I don't often say that. Who are the Arkan Rohingya Salvation Army? The government calls it a terrorist organisation and says its leaders have been trained abroad. The International Crisis Group also says the militants have trained abroad and released a report in 2016 saying the group was led by Rohingya people living in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
The ICG says ISIS's leader is Uta Allah, who was born in Pakistan and raised in Saudi Arabia. The Saudis have an enormous amount to do with... I don't know if you've ever seen the film Zardoz, where this great head turns up and guns start coming out from the mouth of the head and falling on the people. So they've said, look, you can uprise, and given them the guns. And then who comes along to arm the Burmese government afterwards? Israelis.
Yeah.
The Israelis have turned up on the scene. So this is actually, in a way, an offshoot. And I'll put links up to those two articles, one about the... Saudis arming the Rohingyas and then the Israelis arming the Burmese army on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. But it's almost like it's an offshoot of what's going on in the Middle East.
Everything's connected to everything else, Tony. We're moving towards a World War III situation. Whether it happens or not, that's where we're at. And these conflicts are fought out over enormous distances and involve all sorts of players. And, you know, unfortunately for the people who live in this particular region, they are in the front line, as many people in Kashmir and elsewhere are.
Is there any evidence it's hotting up at the moment?
Well, it's obviously fairly low down the Western news agenda, but nevertheless, I'm sure it's quite unpleasant for those people who are caught up in it all.
Also, there's an election in Israel, isn't there?
This is
happening any time now, an electioneering going on with Netanyahu using it as a chance to say, basically, I'm going to annex the parts of the Palestinian territory.
Yep, that's what he's promising.
So, I mean, that could cause backlash as well, couldn't it? I mean, it does seem very tense in the Middle East. But anyway, let's take a step back from all that now and go to one of our super brains. No longer with us. He's super brain number two. And this is my little idea of a series to have of people that you will never hear and never see on the mainstream press. But you will find them online. Of course, there probably are people out there who would much rather that they weren't available. But they are. And certainly people like Anthony Sutton, we're going to hear from now, have got an enormous amount to say. And here he is talking in the late 1980s about a 150-year secret, which was revealed by him, about how US politics is controlled. It's a society called the Scum. Well, it's other people have helped in that process, but he's one of the main authors on the subject. In a book called America's Secret Establishment. But here he is speaking, Anthony Sutton, about the Council on Foreign Relations, War and Revolution, the Society of Skull and Bones.
George Bush's father, Prescott Sheldon Bush, was also a member of the Order, He was a member of Brown Brothers Harriman, which is the Harriman Private Banking Company. So today you've got two men who are supposedly in politics in opposition, Bush and Harriman. Actually, they're members of the same secret society. And Bush's father was not only a member, he was a partner in what was then Harriman & Company, which later became Brown Brothers Harriman. So behind the scenes, and this is something you don't see until you investigate it, people who appear to be in opposition politically or financially or industrially are working together. Other members might be William Buckley. Now, William Buckley became a member in 1949, but the preceding class to that was Bush, 1848. So you get Bush was amongst the 15 who selected Buckley. And Buckley's club, that 15, was the 15 that selected, for example, one of the new members for 50 was the Reverend Sloan Coffin Jr. The Reverend Sloan Coffin Jr. at Yale was at the core of the anti-Vietnamese war disturbances on Yale campus. This is typical. You'll find that men in the same society will take opposite positions in public. So you've got William Buckley, whom I call a House conservative, as a member, but so is a man, for example, called Edwin Burt, who has a string of communist affiliations, which is about that long. And we'll get into this later. The method they use is that of the Hegelian dialectic. Thesis played against antithesis leads to a synthesis. In other words, for history to make progress, for Hegel, you have to have conflict. And when you look at the key people in the order, you will find that they generate conflict. So Bush and Harriman politically are conflicting. Coffin and Buckley, although part of the same order, are in public conflicting with one another because conflict leads to the new synthesis. Other prominent members, one of the most prominent was Howard William Taft, the only man to be both president and chief justice of the United States. The Taft family founded the order in the United States. There have been eight Taft family members within the order. Taft was probably the most prominent member around the turn of the century, 1910, 1920. There was Stimson, who was Secretary of War under Taft, then Secretary of State under Hoover, Secretary of War under Roosevelt. In other words, at that level, politics disappears, and people often wonder, why does a Democrat join a Republican administration? If you check back, you find often there's not as a member of the order. So key people would be people like Taft, Stimson, Archibald MacLeish, who wrote the Constitution for UNESCO, also Librarian of Congress, the Bush family, the Walker family. And above all today, if there's a godfather in the order, it's Avril Harriman.
What causes does the order espouse, and are these divergent to those of our founding fathers?
Well, the causes one can only deduce at this point from the operations of these men as individuals and working together. They want to acquire power above all, political power. As you look at their actions, the political power is to bring about what they call a new world order, which is a one world. But they use the Hegelian techniques. We know enough about Hegel to know that not only does this mean the dialectic process, the creation of conflict, but it also means that individuals such as you and I, or anybody watching this program, will be cogs in the state, that we have no individual rights. Individual rights for Hegel come about through obedience to the state. We see it in the educational process, which we'll probably talk about later, that we have adopted what I call a Hegelian system of education, which is not to bring out your innate talents, but to prepare you to be an individual cog in the state.
Now, are you saying the members of the order believe this, and this is a part of their worldview?
Undoubtedly, the 20% that are active have this goal. If you look at Taft, Taft's great work, although as a president he hasn't accounted for very much in the literature, Taft's great work was to bring about the World Court, international law. international law and a world court will be essential in the new world order. If we take, for example, the career of Vice President Bush, when he was ambassador to the United Nations, he helped a process called Mundialization, which was a process by which an individual American city would adopt United Nations stature. In other words, it's a diminution, a dilution of U.S. sovereignty. So if you look at these individuals, Stimson is another very good example. Abel Harriman, certainly, in the way he's financed the Soviet Union, his work towards the build-up of the Soviet Union. If you look at these individuals and ask what is the common pattern is the creation of a one world.
Now, supposedly, these people believe that they are great benefactors of our society, the wise men, those who are especially endowed to rule, and who also believe that the best interests of America happen to be their own best interests as well.
I have never seen anything in their literature which leads me to believe that they have our individual rights in their hearts. What I do see in the literature and in the documents is a ruthless drive to acquire power for themselves and to help each other, because this is one of the tenets of the order, that if you have three men coming before you for a job, the preference absolutely goes to your brother in the order. This is in my book, The Order, Introduction to the Order. I call these the chains of influence, and I trace one pattern where Stimson brought the McBundy family into the War Department. Then the McBundys go on and become key people both in the Department of Defense and in the Council on Foreign Relations. They help each other along the way. And when you get even a small number of men doing this, it can exert a very powerful force, a very powerful influence.
So the basic assumption is that because they know what is best for America, the way to preserve that is to amass power to see to it that the destiny they envision comes to pass.
My assessment is they're not thinking what is best for America, they're thinking what is best for the order.
What is best for the order
first
is what is best for America. In the first
in their eyes.
Order.
Yes, in their eyes.
What's
yes.
good for us has to be good for America, so we will remold America mm-hmm. according to
the pattern.
That's right.
Yeah. It remains secret for 150 years because these people are under an oath not to talk about it. I understand that a member of the order may not remain in the room if it comes under discussion. Now, if I can elaborate on this a little bit, this poses a problem for Mr. Bush, because I write something called the Phoenix Letter, which is a monthly newsletter, and last November I began to open up. And a reader wrote to Mr. Bush and said, is what Mr. Sutton says, are you a member of this order? And the letter the reader got back was very interesting. It said, in effect, that the vice president was not a member of a sordid secret society. That was not the question. The question was, are you a member of a secret society? The answer came back, he is not a member of a sordid secret society. Inserted the word, you see. This was a reader who doesn't give up, so he went back again. And I understand that, as it stands, as we are now, that Mr. Bush is not willing either to admit he is a member of the order or to deny it, because they're under this oath not to discuss it.
So when people look at the Council on Foreign Relations, in effect what they've been doing is looking at a kind of a veil which hides the order?
Yes. The core, or my work came about almost by accident. If someone had not donated to me the membership list, we wouldn't be here today. It's remained secret because nobody has done that. Everybody's been looking at the Council on Foreign Relations, the Trilateral Commission, the Bilderbergers. They're not truly conspiracies because the membership lists are open. The membership list of the order has not been open. So there's a distinction between the CFR and the Trilaterals and the order. CFR and Trilaterals are not conspiracies because they are not secret. They do what comes naturally. And this, of course, is very different argument to many people who have promoted conspiracy have made. They get across the idea that these people telephone each other and have little drawings and maps and diagrams. They don't operate like that at all. If you meet these people, they think alike. They talk alike. They come up with the same idea simultaneously and they move simultaneously. They know what they have to do.
So they're a breed.
They're a breed. Exactly.
Now, Tony, what has this breed done? What are their chief accomplishments in molding a domestic and foreign policy and actual events in American history since their founding at Yale?
One is they have acquired enormous political and financial power. You'll find representatives of the order in politics.
What have they done with this power? What has happened to America that would not have happened had they not been the order?
Creation of war and revolution.
Specifically, which ones?
The third book in this series, which I'm bringing out, takes two wars and one revolution. Two revolutions in one war. World War II, the Bolshevik Revolution, and the rise of Hitler, which I call a revolution in Germany. We can find the order behind the Russian Revolution, the Bolshevik Revolution. We can find the behind the rise of Hitler. We can find the behind, in the maintenance of both of these systems, the transfer of technology to both.
Since you've already proven that Wall Street is behind the Bolshevik Revolution and the rise of Hitler, now you're proving that the order is behind Wall Street.
Exactly.
Well, that's Professor Anthony Sutton there speaking back in the late 1980s. And Martin, the points he's making are pretty strong, that a secret organisation was really only revealed in the 1980s. It had been secret for 150 years because the oaths that those people are part of it swear are so absolutely watertight. Even if the order is discussed in the room, you walk out. But I've been looking at the sort of comparison to the UK, and in the Second World War, there was something called the Other Club, which Winston Churchill was part of, which he met every week at the Savoy. People like Oswald Mosley, who were totally diametrically opposed to him politically. So this does sound like maybe there's something similar was going on in the UK.
Well, it's not a surprise that the rich and the powerful get together to plot to do what they want to do. It's hardly a surprise, is it? It's just, you know, they'll find various pretexts and ways to do it, but they've been doing it throughout history, and therefore there's not much doubt that they're still
at it. What about this term New World Order? Because I notice there's been a series on the BBC the last few weeks, on BBC Two, called China, A New World Order. Now, it almost seems as if the mass media is trying to, I suppose, paint China with something that actually has been going on over in the United States particularly too.
Well, I mean, for the last 500 years, the Western powers have dominated the globe. And what's going to happen in the future is quite clearly they're not going to be able to do the things that they used to do in the way that they used to do them. And the big threat to them is China's economic strength and Russia's military strength. And, of course, in combination, that frustrates the West's geopolitical strategy.
I mean, traditionally on this program, we talk about people making money from war. Of course, they do. The arms industry make tremendous amounts of money. Resources can be grabbed and that sort of thing. But we don't often touch on this idea that from a war, you can often create chaos and then bring the outcome you want from that.
Yeah, well, I mean, what's happened throughout most of Western history is that there's been a sort of privilege bubble in which, you know, lucky people in lucky countries have been protected from all of this nonsense. And of course, out there in the ungoverned spaces, chaos is used as a mechanism of control of poor people. And, you know, it's been going on for a long time and it's intensified in the last 20 or 30 years.
What do you make of Anthony Sutton's assertion, though? I mean, he's written two books he's hinted at there. In fact, the person interviewing him was saying Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution and Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler. Is it feasible that both of these movements had money from Wall Street?
There's strong evidence that the Nazis were supported by Wall Street. I think that's pretty clear. I think the evidence that they ran the Russian Revolution is less obvious. I think I find that hard to
accept.
Wasn't
it Alan Bullock? He was one of your teachers.
He was the master of St. Catherine's.
Because he pointed out that there are actually quite a lot of parallels with Hitler.
Well, he wrote
Stalin.
A book, Hitler and Stalin, Parallel Lives, because of course they lived at the same time and they were both brutal dictators, but they were rather different in their methods. So, for example, Hitler used to delegate a lot to other people. And that's, you know, we're coming on to talk about Bormann in a minute. That gave Bormann his power. Whereas Stalin was the Russian version of Bormann. he ran the whole show, and he came to dominate the Bolshevik Party from controlling the bureaucracy of the party. He was basically regarded as a rather humdrum guy to just keep the records and, you know, be a kind of secretary for the party.
But both of them were quite messed up individuals.
They were both very nasty people, let's put it that way. But, of course, Stalin never trusted anybody. He ultimately killed virtually everybody who knew him. Yeah, he killed everybody that was associated with him. Hitler, on the other hand, was quite laissez-faire. He killed quite a lot of people, but he surrounded himself with people who... Hitler relied on charisma. People liked Hitler. People didn't like Stalin. They were just absolutely terrified of him. So at some stages during his reign, you know, they'd have these people clapping Stalin at party conferences, and nobody dared to sit down first. So they're clapping for an hour and a half because nobody dares to sit down. Hitler was much more free, you know,
okay,
much more kind
about
of free
Hitler
form.
And Stalin's, Hitler and Stalin, let's have a look at the attempt apparently by the Nazis to assassinate Stalin. And this is an event which is recounted in William Stevenson's book, which is, gosh, what is it? It's called The Bormann Brotherhood. What he says is, I'll just read it out, Martin. He says, Stalin was to be assassinated. Only Hitler and Bormann knew the details. Bormann was Hitler's secretary at this point in the war. A conference would be arranged so that Ribbentrop himself could come face to face with the Russian leader. The Führer said, one man cannot do it alone. An accomplice is necessary. Schellenberg, in considerable apprehension as to who that accomplice was likely to be, trotted off to see if his technical experts could produce a tiny revolver that would look like a fountain pen. It had to be capable of firing a heavy caliber bullet with a reasonable accuracy at a range between 18 and 25 feet. Schellenberg thought they were all mad. Bormann did not agree with him in specific terms, but Bormann never did commit himself. This is the guy who was basically managing. This is not the quoting, but you know, he was managing Hitler at the time, Bormann was. But Bormann never did commit himself in such delicate matters. He told me, however, that the proposal to kidnap the Pope would be sidetracked. The attempt on Stalin's life did not go forward, according to Schellenberg, but not along the lines of Ribbentrop's suicidal suggestion. That one was eased out of Hitler's mind by Bormann, using the standard procedure he long ago explained to Skorzeny. Agree, report progress, let time pass, and then gradually introduce obstacles. So he had no intention, Bormann, of going along with this, but the idea was that he was kind of encouraging Hitler, but at the same time knowing that he was going to have to let him down in the long term. Agree, report progress, let time pass, then gradually introduce obstacles.
Yeah, anybody who tried to do that to Stalin would have ended up dead. So that's two different ways in which these dictatorships operated. If I was a Nazi, the assassination of Stalin, I would regard it as rather pointless because somebody else is just going to take over. Stalin, in actual fact, was a rubbish general, and he nearly lost. He believed Hitler. Hitler was the only person who ever successfully double-crossed Stalin, because Stalin genuinely believed that Hitler was his friend, and when Hitler turned on him, he hid in his room for days on end and refused to come out and give any orders at a time when the front was collapsing in 1941. And eventually people plucked up enough courage to knock on the door from the Central Committee of the Communist Party and say, Comrade Stalin, what should we do? And he thought they'd come to execute him. And he was absolutely stunned when they said, oh, no, we've not come to execute you. We just want to have some orders, please. And then, of course, he then got back in the saddle and off he went. But, of course, what he did...
Well, the rest is history.
Yeah, well, the rest is history. What he did do, Stalin was quite wise. He allowed Zhukov to run the battle, whereas Hitler wouldn't let his generals run the war. He wanted to run the war for them. That
well,
was
as
his
we're,
big mistake.
As we're hearing there, when there was an order given by Hitler, which didn't have to be passed down the line, Bormann would sort of pat him on the back saying, wonderful, and actually slowly but surely
that's right.
Say,
so
well,
Hitler basically was being manipulated by Bormann. Nobody manipulated Stalin, he manipulated everybody else.
So Bormann got his position as Reichsleiter, which was the head of the Nazi party, after Hess's flight to Britain in 1941. This was a bit of a strange incident, Martin, and apparently Hitler went crazy when he heard that Hess had decided to try and do his own little peace mission. He was encouraged by various people, including Tancred Brennius, who was the Finnish ambassador to Nazi Germany. He said, oh, well, I think, you know, you could save everything by going to Britain. And this conveniently got Hess out of the way, didn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think Bormann was quite happy to see Hess do that, and then turn around to Hitler and say, look at Hess, terrible, you better put me in charge. And that's basically what happened.
So we know from reading OpJB and from various interviews around it, the author John Ainsworth Davis, the pen name Christopher Crichton, that there was a British commando mission right at the very end of the war, using all sorts of other international soldiers, including a Jewish contingent, a German contingent as well, but mostly British commandos led by Ian Fleming and John Ainsworth Davis to get Bormann out right from under the noses of the Russians.
Yeah, that's right. And of course, he then turned up in Argentina some years later, and Paul Manning, who was a senior correspondent for CBS in World War II, wrote the book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, because he'd escaped, basically.
Yeah, he discovered Bormann was over in South America at that point. And the thing is, this chap Paul Manning wasn't just anybody. He was the voice of the European war for American listeners.
That's right.
The CBS radio. Absolutely
mainstream journalist in American terms, yeah.
So we've got this gap, though. Bormann arrives 1945, apparently in Britain, according to Christopher Crichton and OpJB, and then suddenly he's disappears for, 12 years or so, 1956. Apparently, according to Christopher Crichton in his book, he believed that that was when he left Britain, because there was a very important state visit from the Soviet Union, and the British Prime Minister at the time was concerned that the KGB might discover Bormann in Britain whilst the Russians were all in the country with all these diplomats and spies. Mm-hmm. And he wanted to get him out of the way. He said that he's an absolute liability being in the UK. So that's why apparently he went in 56.
Well, I mean, as you say, there's plenty of interesting leads to follow in this story. But the take home for people who've heard of this story for the first time is we've got eyewitness evidence from the commandos that actually sprang Bormann, John Ainsworth Davis, that he was rescued, and he'd been dealing with the Western powers for quite a long time. And of course, as the Nazi regime collapsed, lots of Nazis were integrated into NATO as intelligence officers and so on. And therefore, that explains a lot about the, fascist psychological warfare techniques of NATO intelligence services.
I mean, a lot of people are sceptical about OpJB, but it is endorsed by Winston Churchill and endorsed in letters in the book, and by Mountbatten.
They've got photographs of letters given to Ainsworth Davis by Churchill and Mountbatten and Fleming, saying, after we're all dead, you can tell the truth about what you did. The book is called OpJB because it was actually called Operation James Bond. And therefore, Ian Fleming, when he wrote the James Bond books later on, used the term James Bond for his hero as a kind of wink to those in the know, because the rescue of Bormann was called Operation James Bond. And that hence the name of the book by Creighton Davis, OpJB. And if you read the book, it looks pretty convincing to me. This guy's very much, I think he's telling the truth.
Having a few problems with that clip for some reason, but I'll try another method. What about what was Bormann up to in South America?
Well, when he got to South America, he basically the main point about this was the Red House meeting after the Battle of the Falaise Gap, which was taken in Strasbourg, and this is all in Manning's book as well about Bormann being in Latin America, and they realised that they're losing the war, and Bormann basically opened negotiations with the British intelligence services initially to say, we know we're going to lose the war. What we're going to do is we're going to move, we're going to do a deal with you. You've got to help us to escape, and we will move all he had all the industrialists come to this meeting, the German industrialists who cooperated with Hitler, and they removed all the money from the country so that the occupying powers would not get it. And then, once they'd done that, they brought it back in, which is one of the reasons why he had the Wirtschaftswunder, the German economic miracle, in the late 40s and early 50s, because the former Nazi industrialists and Nazi party members like Bormann were basically working behind the scenes with Western intelligence.
The key to this being that Bormann was the signatory to all the big bank accounts.
That's right. Bormann knew where all the money. But Bormann was the money man. Basically, he knew where all the money was.
And a lot of it was, of course, in Switzerland. Anyway, let's go now, courtesy of Grace Philby, to Reigate to pick up the story in 1945.
About 20 years ago, there was a reporter who interviewed a man who claimed he was Martin Bormann's son. And he claimed that after the war, Martin Bormann had escaped to England or had been captured by the British, was interrogated, and for whatever reasons, maybe to do with the Nazi goals, who knows, he was given sanctuary, and that Martin Bormann lived out his life with his wife in Ray Common Road in Reigate. The son took the reporter to his house and showed him data that proved his claim that Martin Bormann was his father. I don't know what that data was, but photographs and all sorts of things. The reporter went away and started to write a story, which was published. Subsequently, the son was arrested on a drugs charge. While the son was on remand in custody, he supposedly committed suicide by hanging himself. The reporter went back to the house, gained access to the house, possibly illegally, and the data that had been there was no longer there. He couldn't find it. Now, he took on to continue investigating, because Martin Bormann's son actually supposedly had a sister who lived in New Malden. And they wanted me to go and knock on this sister's door in New Malden and ask her questions about whether she was Martin Bormann's daughter. I said, you must be joking. You know, if the authorities have actually killed his son, I'm not going to go near it. There were a number of articles in the newspaper about this, but of course, nothing further came of it. It was just one of those stories that disappeared into the mists of time. But if indeed Martin Bormann did live out his days in Reigate, it might have been, once they thought he was safe after the war, they would have let him go out and walked over walks, and he walked round Reigate, and I can well imagine them saying, well, do you know England? Is there anywhere you'd like to live in England? Because we would resettle you and give you a new name. And he said, well, I don't know England at all, but Reigate seems a nice little town. This will do. And the official was that Martin Bormann went to South America.
Well, that's an interview by Grace Philby. We had her on the other week talking about, she's a Churchill Fellow, or was a Churchill Fellow. She died a couple of years ago. We had her on talking about bacteriophages. She was very much an independent-minded, spirited journalist and writer, and she was very interested in pursuing this story. I mean, the place where this all took place, Martin, around this whole area in Reigate, was actually where Montgomery was based, and it was called the South Eastern Regional Command Centre during World War II.
Well, yes, I mean, it's interesting information. I mean, this guy obviously had something to do with it, because he was asked, was it the Sun newspaper that was pursuing this story? Was he working for the Sun?
No, well, he didn't give the name of the newspaper. He said about 20 years ago.
Oh, I see. So I thought when he said the Sun...
He said it was in the national newspaper.
Yeah. So in other words, this is somebody who's got, somebody who's claiming that they were told to go and investigate this story, and they decided
rather than saying, yes, I will go to New Malden or whatever and take this further, they're maybe sensibly saying, well, I don't think I fancy that, actually.
No.
Particularly since this guy apparently has just died. Of course, the other thing is, if it was Martin Bormann's son, he may not have died in prison. He may have been given a new identity, and he's, you know, he may have had a ceremony, a funeral, that he's died.
Yeah.
Only maybe one,
well,
or
if you
two,
read Op J,
one or two people.
If you read Op JB, they take somebody on the expedition with them who doesn't realise what their role is, and they look like Bormann, and they've got the same teeth. They did dental work on them, so they've got the six. This is before DNA analysis, so he's got the same teeth as Bormann, and he was actually shot dead at the end of the thing, so that everybody thinks Bormann's dead, they've got a body that looks like Borman with the same dental profile.
Well, this is a
this guy wasn't told what he was being taken
another
out for.
Another thing Grace and these group of people in Reigate were saying is that this guy possibly could have been some kind of doppelganger.
Well, indeed, because in the Second World War, it'd be more difficult to do today, but in the Second World War, there was a famous film, I Was Monty's Double, and it's based on real events. Somebody who looked like Montgomery, used to go around pretending to be Montgomery, and it was a standard tactic of intelligence services in that era. More difficult to do now, because you can just do a DNA test and you immediately identify who somebody is, because they used to identify people by dental records. So if you just make your dental work that makes it look the same as somebody, then you can have a body with the right dental profile, and then you've got a dead doppelganger.
Okay, so the books are Op JB by Christopher Crichton, published in the 1990s and published in the early 1980s. The other one is Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile by Paul Manning. So next week, James Files and attempts on his life after he was involved in the assassination of John F. Kennedy. He talks about surviving those, as well as Zionist terrorism in 1946. Time to sign off for the US Own Comcast News at 8 o'clock. Thanks to our guest in the first hour, Desi Latin from the Brexit Party. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. You'll find us all online on this programme, thisweekoneword.org.
This is Bristol's UK.
Have a relaxing,
BCFM
enjoyable BCFM weekend. Our sister show Dialects on Tuesday
on
at noon here. Please join us for the politics show at 6 o'clock next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
Bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 8. David Cameron admits he thinks about the consequences of the EU referendum every single day. But the former Prime Minister's defended holding it because he feels Europe was an issue the country needed to address. He's criticised Conservative Party colleagues involved in the Leave campaign, saying they trashed